Bases in Iraq and Syria come under fresh attack amid growing anti-U.S. sentiment over its complicity in the Israeli atrocities in Gaza. And Bahrain's National Assembly is pressing to reverse the normalization of the country's relations with Israel in reaction to the regime's genocide in the Gaza Strip. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Israel is pressing ahead with its deadly war on Gaza for more than a month. In every single part of the besieged Palestinian land, sounds of bombardment are followed by screams of mothers losing their kids and the cries of children whose parents are killed. The death toll from the Israeli war since October 7th has topped 10,300. Some 6,500 victims are women and children, and the regime keeps raining down bombs on residential buildings. In the latest airstrikes, dozens were killed in Deir al-Bala. 11 members of the family were also killed in the southern city of Khan Yunis. Medical facilities aren't safe from the regime's onslaught either. Despite international condemnation, war planes targeted Gaza's largest medical facility, Al-Shifa Hospital. It hosts 170 injured people and hundreds more displaced Palestinians. In the meantime, the city of Khan Yunis and south of Gaza Strip has been hit hard by the Israeli air raids and shelling. People there regard the United States as a complicit in the war and Israeli crimes against Palestinians.
The U.S. as a government and a country is considered as complicit in this fighting because it's the head of disbelief and obstinacy. It's the real enemy. Israel is backed by the U.S., and if it weren't for the U.S., there would not have been an Israel. It's the real enemy, and we are now being killed with American weapons. The reality is there are children there, right over there. Maybe this strike caused the least amount of children death, but usually most of those killed in strikes are children and women and people who have nothing to do with anything in this world. But this is how it is. They lie and believe their lies.
This war is conducted by the U.S. support, and the U.S. said that if there is no Israel, we would have to invent one. The U.S. is fighting on behalf of Israel. The U.S. is the one who is conducting this war. Where is the U.S. conscience? Where are the educated and wise people? They are annihilating people who own nothing, defenseless people who have no weapons, no military, no flights, and no battleships. I'm 50 years old, and I've never seen strikes like these. The strikes is destroying 10 homes.
Now, an American journalist has warned U.S. officials that they could face legal actions for their complicity in the war crimes and genocide in Gaza. Saddam Hussein issued the warning while attending a press briefing at the U.S. State Department.
Craig Mochaber, who just resigned as director of the New York office of the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights, noted that intent, usually the hardest part of genocide to prove, isn't in this case. He wrote in his resignation letter, quote, "Explicit statements of intent by leaders in the Israeli government and military leave no room for doubt or debate." You claim that you want Israel to make the distinction, but you don't seem to be making the distinction. I didn't interrupt you. The Center for Constitutional Rights just put out a statement. Legal organizations put members of Congress on notice for complicity on genocide. Quote, "Please take note," this is a letter that they sent to members of Congress, Center for Constitutional Rights. "Please take notice that should you vote in favor of that package, the Biden package for Israel, you risk facing criminal and civil liabilities for aiding and abetting genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity under international law, and may face investigation and prosecution." Do members of the State Department face similar possibility?
Again, Sam, as I said, we have the U.S. government has a rigorous process in place for evaluating whether something constitutes genocide, and we have not made that assessment in
but
this case.
But you continue to pretend that the bombing of hospital after hospital, bakery after bakery, university after university, and somehow you keep pretending that, oh, they're just after military.
Now, the military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, has continued retaliatory attacks against the Israeli military that's pushing ahead with the ground invasion of Gaza. The Al-Qassam Brigade says it's dealt a blow to the regime's military by destroying 11 tanks and military vehicles in northern Gaza. Resistance fighters used Al-Yasin missiles to target Israeli armored vehicles approaching the Al-Shati refugee camp. Since the beginning of the Israeli ground offensive in Gaza, 97 of Israeli armored vehicles have been either partially or completely destroyed. Early on Tuesday, Qassam brigades also performed missile strikes against the city of Sderot in Israel's south. Also on Monday, it fired 60 missiles from southern Lebanon at Israeli targets in the occupied territories for the first time since Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Now, in the meantime, two American military bases in Iraq and Syria have come under fresh attacks amid growing anti-U.S. sentiment in West Asia. An Iraqi resistance group says it successfully hit the Al-Harir airbase housing U.S. troops in Iraq's Kurdistan region with multiple drones. The group says another U.S. base called Ain al-Khazra in Syria was targeted in another drone attack. No immediate reports of casualties or damage from those strikes. Just a week ago, the U.S. confirmed drone attacks on the same site that caused injuries to some of its troops. Several U.S.-run facilities, including Ain al-Assad Air Base in Iraq, have come under attacks recently, and that amid outrage at Washington's support for Tel Aviv's deadly onslaught on Gaza. Resistance factions in Iraq and elsewhere in the region have repeatedly warned the U.S. against funding and backing the Israeli war machine. The Deputy Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says that the October 7th operation will have a great impact on the Israeli regime in the future.
Al-Aqsa flood operation is an exceptional operation, which is unprecedented since the establishment of the Zionist regime in Palestine in 1948. And we believe it will be a turning point for the future. It planted the seeds which would lead to the regression and downfall of the regime, since it uncovered that the Israeli security capabilities are extremely weak, the Israeli army is very weak, and the politicians know nothing and cannot envision the future. We are facing an artificial entity which shows in appearance that it has strength, but in reality it has a deep weakness in everything that they have. And it's not only a weakness in their occupation and aggressive project, but also in the practical performance of their army and security apparatus and politicians.
In an interview with Press TV, Sheikh Naim Qassam said that the victory of any faction of the Resistance Alliance against Israel would be a victory for all movements in the region. He added, Operation Al-Aqsa Flood proved the theory of Israel being weaker than a spider web to be correct. The official underlined that the regime is alive on foreign support that's from the U.S. and the EU, and it cannot survive on its own. Qassam said that Israel wants to destroy all resistance groups in Palestine, but he added that it will be difficult for the regime to achieve its objectives once Hezbollah intervened.
Calls have not stopped, whether from foreign or Arab states, directly or indirectly, calling on us not to enlarge our intervention in the battle. And they are also calling on us to stop our intervention in this confrontation facing the Israeli regime. We responded to all of them in the following. Instead of asking us not to intervene, ask Israel and the U.S. to stop. Our intervention is a reaction to the Israeli aggression on Gaza. You cannot ask those who are reacting to this not to have a reaction, and you are justifying the aggression and allowing it to continue under the pretext of self-defense, while they are actually killing the civilians and children and striking hospitals and the places of worship and schools and so on. We say they should go to the Zionist regime and the U.S., which is safeguarding this occupation, and tell them to stop, and then everything could stop. But you cannot tell us to stop and leave Israel, and even support Israel to do as it wishes and continue its assaults on civilians and not fighting resistance fighters. This is unacceptable.
Sheikh Qassam further said that the resistance front will take necessary measures based on the developments on the ground. He added that there are enough reasons for the unity of resistance movements, given that the U.S. and the EU and their allies keep backing Israeli aggression against Palestinians. The Hezbollah official underscored that any movement with any belief can come together with the resistance front. Now, Russia has questioned an Israeli minister's call for using nuclear weapons against Palestinians in Gaza, a threat that has drawn international condemnation. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova says that the Israeli threat has raised a huge number of questions. Zakharova said that the main issue is that Israel appears to have admitted that it has nuclear weapons. Tel Aviv does not publicly acknowledge its nuclear arsenal and doesn't allow international inspection of its nuclear facilities, but the regime is believed to possess some 400 nuclear warheads. The recent remark by the Israeli minister Amichai Eliyahu that one of the regime's options is to drop a nuclear bomb on Gaza drew criticism, with Iran calling for a swift international response. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullah has said that the UN Security Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency must take immediate and uninterrupted action to disarm the barbaric regime. Now, Bahrain's National Assembly is pressing to reverse the normalization of relations between the Persian Gulf Kingdom and Israel. That, according to the Deputy Speaker of Bahrain's legislative body, Abdul Nabi Salman, says that the demands of the lawmakers are a reflection of the aspiration of the people. He said that the most important public demand is severing all ties with Israel and canceling the Abraham Accords. Ultimately, any decision on the Bahrain-Israel ties is made by the Bahraini king and his government. Bahrain recalled its ambassador to Israel last week amid the regime's atrocities in Gaza. Flights between the two sides were also suspended. Bahrain was one of the few Arab nations that signed the unpopular U.S.-backed normalization agreements with Israel in 2020. All right, from Dublin, let's bring in Asad Abu Shaq, a Palestinian academic and activist. Good to have you with us, sir. So you just heard about this normalization thing, you know, a few Arab states doing that a couple of years back with the U.S. pushing for that. Now we have Bahrain, one of those signatories to that deal that the Palestinians find as a stab in their back. It just, there's a sea change, it, what seems to be, and they are going to reverse this. So let's discuss that a bit.
Look, it's not only Bahrain. The Palestinians, the question which presses upon the brain of any Palestinian, every Palestinian, anywhere in Palestine and outside Palestine, is that why all the world, European world and America and European Union, are supporting Israel, giving every possible support, leading the genocidal war, the propaganda genocidal war, sending volunteers, weapons, F-16s, F-35s, closing even the borders and killing the Palestinians by the minute. All the Europe, all United States of America, whereas the Muslim and the Arab world are dead silent, doing nothing, just nothing. The children of Israel are being butchered by the minute. The women are butchered by the minute. The people are butchered by the minute. Now, well over 10,000 Palestinians have been killed in cold blood, mm-hmm. thousands injured, homes, hospitals, everything, schools. So, it's not only the those countries which betray the Palestinian people and naturalized relations, normalized relations with Israel. Mm-hmm. It's the Muslim and the Arab countries who are standing idle by. Standing idle. They didn't, for example, expel one Israeli ambassador. They didn't expel one American ambassador or one French ambassador or British, or they didn't cut off oil or gas or whatever. So I think the whole Muslim and Arab world are held guilty and part of the crime of the genocide which is committed against the Palestinian people. And this is why what we call for is to end any relations with Israel, to open the fronts, to send humanitarian aid, to stop this genocidal war, to bring the leaders, not only of Israel, but the leaders of America, of Britain, of France, who are participating in this genocidal war, to criminal court for the part they are playing in destroying the Palestinian people. If they manage to destroy Palestine, Gaza, the other day they will move to Egypt, to Lebanon, to Syria, to even to Iran, to anybody, because you see, this is their program. They have a program, and they are being supported by the Americans. And now they want to extend their land from Euphrates to the Nile, and that includes most of the Arab world and parts of the Muslim world as well.
Okay, thank you so much, Asad Abu Shaq, Palestinian academic and activist in Dublin. Now moving on to the Japanese capital, people have filled the streets to express solidarity with Palestinians and demand an end to the Israeli war on Gaza. The demonstration took place ahead of a G7 foreign ministerial meeting in Tokyo.
I want the powerful people in the world to oppose what Israel is doing, which is a genocide in Gaza.
I came to the protest to demand them to stop the massacre of people in Gaza.
Now the ralliers marched on a road near the venue of the G7 summit. They held Palestinian flags and placards reading Peace for Gaza and Blinken, shame on you. Anton Blinken is U.S. Secretary of State, who is set to attend a G7 meeting together with foreign ministers from six other developed economies. The two-day event is set to revolve around the Russia-Ukraine war and the Israeli war on Gaza. The pro-Palestine demonstration in Tokyo is one of the numerous rallies being held across the world in support of the people in Gaza. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we interview lawyer, activist, human rights advocate, and a leading voice in civic nationalism. He's Secretary of Ireland's Future, an organisation established to promote, debate and discuss the viability of new constitutional arrangements in the event of United Ireland. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrol. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Niall Murphy. Niall is a leading light in the growing campaign for Irish unity. He also represents many victims in their search for truth and justice with regards to state violence during the conflict. Niall Murphy, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here, Sean. Thanks for the invitation.
Now, before we begin, what motivated your foray into the legal world?
I've always had a sense of what's right and wrong, you know, just as most, you know, people who are reared in houses where that's important. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I was at school. Sort of chose law as a default, not knowing what to do. Law was something that you could go on and build and do anything. And as I was studying and just becoming older and a bit more socially mature and understanding, you know, the issues which afflicted society at that time, I went to Queen's from 1985 to 1988. So it was a period of political transition, and your eyes become more acutely aware of life around you. When I was finished my degree, I applied for a job in Madden and Finucane Solicitors in Castle Street, and I'll never forget it. Last exam, I think it was the 1st of June. The interview was the 2nd of June, and I started on the 3rd of June, and that's been me since.
So, Niall, that sense of justice and injustice that you had then obviously inspired you to concentrate on your work on human rights law.
Yes, you know, growing up, there was an innate awareness that we were being raised in a society which was institutionally imbalanced, that the enjoyment in life, be it playing Gaelic games or reveling in the culture of our music and our dance, or obviously our Irish language, and understanding that that wasn't, you know, cherished on a societal basis, and that our practice of our culture was not something that was mainstream. Didn't see it on TV. I can remember BBC began to broadcast the championship, and it was a huge cultural event, you know, because it had never been on TV. And for all of those reasons and many others, when I did get the opportunity to, you know, put a suit on and go into an office every day, the opportunity to engage with people who were at the cutting edge of injustice and to be able to advocate on their behalf very, very quickly, I appreciated the high sense of privilege that it is to represent somebody, to be their advocate, and to make change.
And you then moved on to a lot of bigger cases, and one, not that one case particularly stands out, but one that we both worked on lately was the Armagh Road massacre. Mm-hmm. Can you just let the audience know a bit about that, and just the intricacies of what information has come forward lately on that case?
Any case where somebody has lost their life is atrocious. It's the most appalling thing that can happen in the next of kin's life, that they have to endure the loss of their loved one. But in circumstances where it's an atrocity, a multi-death incident, it really resonates from the outset as to the seriousness that of what you're dealing with. And then the Armagh Road Bookmakers shooting, 5 people were killed. From the outset, from before the families even sought legal advice, there was strongly held concerns, which then became evidenced, that the atrocity was planned, permitted, and that the killers were then protected from prosecution. And we engaged with the families on the basis of making a complaint at that time to the police ombudsman. But the thing about the truth is that the truth always comes out. And I do have a comfort in regard that state or non-state illegality can't be suppressed forever. I'm not even talking in a bit of local context, anywhere, the truth always comes out. You get the sense sometimes that it's boiling through the pavement. It will come out.
You've been able to carry out that work and to forensically go through the detail of that, but currently the British government are trying to legislate to stop inquests and civil cases. What happens to victims in that scenario then now?
This new legacy bill, which is pending before Parliament, is the most egregious piece of law that has ever been visited upon this island, possibly since the penal times. It is the utter disregard for every citizen resident in this jurisdiction. It is the only political matter which has unified all parties here. There is no support on this island for this bill. Yet it is being rammed through Westminster with abject disregard to the people that it will affect, and it deprives the most vulnerable people in our society of access to justice, of access to the court. Who do they think they are that they can insulate themselves in cases whereby they committed the crime? They are the intended defendant in civil proceedings, for example. What society are we living that it is permissible that a defendant to proceedings can cauterize their own liability and stop those proceedings because they know what they did? In Whitehall, they have the big white wall with the mind map what they did.
Now, Niall, you're a secretary in an organisation called Ireland's Future. Can you tell the audience a bit about that organisation?
Yes, Ireland's Future is just it's a fantastic initiative that I have had the privilege to be associated with. I act as secretary to the organisation, but the organisation is so many people, thousands of people, in fact. And it's a state of mind, really, you know. Anybody who is concerned about our current constitutional arrangements, the undemocratic nature of that, and has an interest in the future, can associate themselves as being Ireland's Future. It's not the privilege of one, you know, set of people or any political party. We're a party political with no allegiance or interest to any formal political party, but we engage with all the political parties who aspire to the reunification of this island. And really our analysis has evolved in live time through the recent Brexit crisis.
You've been very successful in bringing together many inspiring people, a lot of whom are now friends that I've met through the work of Ireland's Future. But how do you see the next decade panning out, Niall? What's your prediction with regards to unity?
Well, I think we're in the decade of change, and sometimes you don't appreciate history when you're living through it, and Brexit is an example of that. At the time of Brexit, it was not long after the centenary of the Easter Rising, and had you spoken to any person that was interested in that anniversary, in their heart of hearts, do you think that reunification is on the menu? I think an honest person would have said no. So that was April 2016. By the 16th of June 2016, 2 months later, the constitutional big bang of our century occurred, Brexit, and nobody understood what it meant. It was an ill-defined question which was solely designed to cure infighting in the British Conservative Party, foisted upon an ignorant, with no disrespect, an unsuspecting public who didn't understand what it meant. They were fed lies, jingoism, racism, and the vote went through against the better wishes of the then Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. So we have lived through an experience of how not to do constitutional change. There requires to be planning, preparation, public engagement, scenario planning, empirical evidence. And it's my sincerely held belief that we are already in a decade of change, that the movement towards constitutional change has sort of outgrown the perspectives of different political parties. And it's on the lips of people in the middle of football that this is the direction of travel. You know, demographics are a crude metric, and I wouldn't, you know, point to them as the sole reason. Absolutely not. But it was the basis upon the foundation of this state, and the demographic change which has occurred, and it's never going back. A unionist majority in this jurisdiction is gone now forever and is never, ever, ever coming back. So society has to understand and respond to that fact. And in, you know, when you add in the abuses of this current government, the decade of austerity which has afflicted our public services, the massive economy which is thriving in the south, and when you look at the work of David McWilliams, for example, he points to the fact that pre-partition, Belfast was bigger than Dublin. The north, the northern six counties were a net contributor to the British Exchequer. That stopped in mid-1930s and has never come back. So partition has failed the north. We do not have an economy. We are reliant upon an inflated, you know, reliance on the wider public civil service, and the opportunity to have a newly vibrant entrepreneurial economy that has happened in the south and has reaped the opportunities that their corporation tax returns prove. That hasn't happened in the north. So the opportunity to revitalise Ireland's second city is Belfast. Ireland's second city is not Cork. To revitalise the opportunities that exist for the talent that is just pouring out of our schools and universities. You know, we're one of the most highly educated areas on the planet, but the highly skilled jobs that our young people are entitled to. So it's really about, you know, imagination, but also it's about reality. And the reality is that we need to plan and prepare for constitutional change. Whereas the work that Ireland's Future does, we procure expert evidence, because social discourse should be informed by actual evidence. It shouldn't be informed by lies or emotion.
So just bringing you back to 2020, we're on the other side of a worldwide pandemic, and you had a bit of a scare yourself. Can you tell us a bit about that now?
Yeah, a very, very serious scare. It was the worst time of my life, and for reasons I'll explain, you know, and I now know, emerging and getting better afterwards, that my first 26th, 27th, 28th, 29th, 30th of March, I became very, very, very ill, and such to the extent that there was the beginnings of some organ failure, such to the extent that my wife received a phone call to say that she needed to steady herself, that I was sick enough to die, and that I might not make it through that night. That was the 30th of March. And I was completely oblivious to all this. Like, it's just the family were going through all of that whilst locked down. My mother, in later months, was so agitated about the scandal, about, you know, the lockdown parties at Downing Street and just the egregious abuse, thinking of my wife and my kids locked down, and she couldn't even call over and make her a cup of tea or, you know, help with the dinner or help with the kids. And everybody went through that. But I turned the corner. I began to get better. I did get better. So I was taken out of the coma, and you're weaned off the medication. And just that whole experience of being in a coma, it's not one I would ever recommend, but it is a life experience. Your life completely in the hands, careful, gentle hands of professionals, and you have no say in the matter other than, you know, how your body reacts, and that's a biological thing. And it was life affirming, just coming around and having nurses, and your head is all over the place because you're being weaned off, you know, very heavy medication, sedatives. And when the doctor was putting me under, he said, "You're going to have very vivid dreams," he called them. They were hallucinations. And I did. And I tell you, the experience of that. I could recollect every second of every moment as if it was a lifetime. There was one of the days I was convinced that one of the children was out. There's like a garden courtyard, or so I thought there wasn't, but in my mind's eye there was, and that she was just playing in the garden and I was just watching her. So that didn't happen. I was also convinced then that my friend and his wife and my wife were at the bedside, and that my wife and the other wife had decided, oh, sure, you're all right now, we'll go out for the night. And sure, you two mind the kids. And I'm obviously hallucinating. Where's the kids? So I apparently, you know, came roundish at about 4 a.m. and tried to get out of the bed, tried to pull all the leads out. And the partners had to, you know, put me down. And I'm, where's my children? Where's my children? And the whole thing was, it was an experience that just gives you so much respect for the medical profession and everybody that works there. As I was coming around, you know, some of the nurses that had looked after me in ICU came into me, and some of them would say, oh, my brother plays for Ahahal and he knows you. Or another one says, I played Camogie for Glenravel. And, you know, just small things that, so there had been social media stuff about me, and there's a lot of stuff from the GA, and, you know, just small personal things that really meant so much. And it was just remarkable. And I had never understood, I've aunties that were nurses, I had never understood what a nurse did for a living. I now do. And when I got out of hospital, one of the things that annoyed me so much was this concept which has arisen of clapping on a Thursday night. And I wasn't, so I was contacted to say, would you mind if we took a photograph of you and your family out clapping? And I thought, these people don't need a clap, they need what they're asking for. Mm-hmm. They need a raise. And I contacted some nurses that had been very good to the family while I was sick, you know, just sort of translating almost the medical speak and where it is actually. And they said, no, it's something that the profession actually are taking a lot of comfort from, and it is something that we're going to, you know, engage with in terms of our industrial action. So I said, right, well, if that's good, then I did. And I did, went out, and the photographers came up and took a photograph. But that, again, that our nurses, not 3 months beforehand, were required to not be paid for a day's work, to risk the pension threatened entitlements that were threatened against them, for safe staffing, for having enough nurses on a ward. And they were run off their feet. And to have pay parity, not a pay increase, pay parity with other nurses in our so-called wider NHS, it just really aggravated me and agitates me to this day. And that sacrifice that those nurses and doctors made at society's time of need has been forgotten about. And that the Tory government, the criminality of this Tory government enriching their friends in industry in these PPE scandals, billions of pounds that have been spent enriching their cabal, is money that could and should have been spent rewarding the most important people in our society, in my view.
Absolutely, Niall, and every single healthcare worker is a hero.
Yep.
But in spite of your brush with death, it didn't stop you from receiving some pretty nasty and vitriolic attacks along with your colleagues by certain sections of loyalism. Does that affect your work?
Ach, listen, it's irrelevant nonsense. Social media is not real life as well. And the pomposity that, you know, some people think that their amount of followers lends credence to their opinion. Their opinion's irrelevant. And I don't care. It's completely water off a duck's back. Empty vessels make the most noise. And it's actually laughable. Pathetic. And insofar as that is pathetic, it's immediately disregardable.
Now, it's always good to see you. I want to thank you for coming in today. And we both wish you all the greatest health in the world after the story we've just heard. You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildernew, alongside our special guest, Niall Murphy, a leading light in the movement for a united Ireland. This week, we take a look at the role of the Black and Tans during the Irish War of Independence, who went on to gain a reputation for brutality and became notorious for reprisal attacks on civilians and civilian property, including extrajudicial killings, arson and looting. Their actions further swayed Irish public opinion against British rule and drew condemnation even in Britain.
The Black and Tans were a British force recruited to assist the Royal Irish Constabulary in maintaining control over the IRA during the Irish War of Independence. Many had been ex-British and Irish soldiers signed up to suppress the Irish uprising, with many committing atrocities against Irish citizens. In September 1920, in revenge for the murder of the RIC district inspector and his brother, the Black and Tans sacked the town of Balbriggan. They burned and destroyed homes and businesses and beat two Republicans to death. As was well recognised at the time, the majority of those attacked were victims innocent of any documented complicity. In Gort in December 1920, two local boys with no IRA connections were murdered by the Black and Tans for what they described as impudence. Their bodies were thrown into a ditch after being dragged behind one of the dreaded lorries until they were unrecognisably mangled. This was just one example of what poet W.B. Yeats referred to in his poem Reprisals as half-drunk or whole-mad soldiery. W.B. Yeats' sister Lily wrote to her father John in December 1920 that after witnessing months of Black and Tan atrocities and having seen a lorry load of them pass her house with reprisals galore scrawled on the side, her political stance changed. As you know, I was no Sinn Féiner a year ago, just a made nationalist. But now... In January 2020, the Fine Gael-led Irish government was humiliated into cancelling a commemoration to the RIC after public pressure, along with opposing parties threatening to boycott the event. Despite denying it amounted to a celebration of the infamous Black and Tans, Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan capitulated to calls for the commemoration to be called off. 100 years on, and the mood from the Irish public on the savagery of the Black and Tans has never waned.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Niall Murphy, and my co-host, Michelle Gildernew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran. And we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil fa. Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we were discussing the different constituents of supplications, and after we finished our discussion, we moved on to the effects of supplication. From the effects of supplication, we concluded one important thing. The fact that these supplications are set of transmitted supplications handed down to us, granted to us through the Ahlul Bayt by the Almighty Allah to be educated. And we see different objectives are being followed and are set within the depths of these infallible imams' traditions and supplications. So the very first objective was the fact that Almighty Allah is the absolute cause, and this is referred to, this is explicitly mentioned in different parts, and this fact is scattered through the different parts of structures of traditions and the supplications with the names and attributes of the Almighty Allah. The second objective is the fact that these infallible imams are engaging in supplications so intensely that sometimes we are amazed. Why would they do that? So this brings this question in our mind. The question is, if these are infallibles, and if these are very divine men, why would they, as the sources of knowledge and treasures of piety, why would they employ so much humbleness? Why would they employ humbleness and flattery to be close to God? We said in the previous episode that this question has got two answers. In first answer, we must be firstly aware that piety, knowledge, power, and glory of the infallible imams is stemming from God's will. So that is why we see that they confess and they say that all these things are given to them from the Almighty Allah. So the greater this perfection of mankind, the greater is our need to come close to Almighty Allah. So the infallible ones are away from their very selves, and they are more in need of the absolute power. To be thankful for this great asset, they would never put supplications and regrets aside. That is why we see so many confessions made in the supplications. They have always pointed to this fact that what there is could be accounted as to be from God. And naturally, this great perfection and absolute dependence causes them to have humbleness. This is what brings them humbleness. That is why they get involved in supplications. And this is an important fact. In this regard, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "I have not stopped flattering you." And from this statement, we can conclude that we may not ascribe to those honorable ones what we will consider appropriate for ourselves, because this is going away from the status of any of the infallible ones.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. so that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will, God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good, about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too, it's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So, this is our first answer to this important question. The second answer is that coming close to God, the Almighty, and receiving the bottomless ocean of glory, absolute power, receiving infinite knowledge, making man closer to the Almighty Allah, all these things make man so humble that he keeps on worshipping God forever. And if he cuts the mountains with his eyelashes, he has not yet compensated for God's favors. And he will always remember to be humbleness and not to forget that. The manifestation of glory, which could divide a mountain into two pieces and could make Moses unconscious, is applied to the infallible ones. Any power compared with the Almighty's power is just nothing. And in this case, there is a reverse relationship. The more a person understands the power of God, the less he will regard himself. No matter how much time he will spend on worshipping or will go on fasting, he will be ashamed in the presence of God. Therefore, he always considers himself as an obedient servant of the Almighty Allah. We'll continue our discussion later on in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
lullaby, my darling. Lullaby, my son, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, son to you, see, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you. Of my roots, Palestine, 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 Palestine. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots we hear, this land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel pounds Gaza's largest medical facility, Al-Shifa Hospital, as the fatalities from more than a month of bombardments of the besieged strip tops.